Hello.
Hey. Welcome to Rosé and DNA, a brand new podcast about women who are making waves in science, healthcare, and tech. I'm Deanna.
And I'm Renee, and we're two professionals working in the field of genetics.
Today we are super excited to have Dr. Heidi Rehm on the podcast. Dr. Rehm got her bachelor's degree in molecular biology and biochemistry from Middlebury College, an MS in biomedical science from Harvard Medical School, and then got her PhD in genetics from Harvard University. She then proceeded to do a postdoctoral training in neurobiology and then a fellowship in clinical molecular genetics at Harvard Medical School.
While there are truly too many accomplishments to highlight them all, some of Dr. Rehm's key accomplishments include being a leader in defining standards for the interpretation of sequence variants and a principal investigator of ClinGen, an NIH-funded project providing free and publicly accessible resources for precision medicine, building the Laboratory for Molecular Medicine within the Harvard Mass General Brigham system. She's also been a leader in the development of various high-impact clinical genomic sequencing studies, such as MedSeq and the BabySeq projects, the Emerge Consortium, and others. Among Dr. Rehm's many honors collected over the years, she received the BWH Physician Recognition Award for Clinical Innovation and the Boston Business Journal's 40 Under 40 Award for Civic Leadership. She now serves as the Chief Genomic Officer at Mass General Hospital and is an institute member and scientist at the Broad Institute.
So let's get started. So today we are extremely excited to have Dr. Heidi Rehm on the podcast. And full disclosure, Heidi is our boss, so we work very closely with her. So this is technically not our first happy hour with her. But I think for both of us, we've been looking forward to this for quite a while, just to learn a little bit more about your career, you know, what's gotten you to where you are, what's been the kind of key to success in your experience. And for myself, as you know, we were prepping for this, thinking about questions we wanted to ask you, I was thinking back to the first time I saw you or talked to you or met you, which was about 2013 or 2012, I think. I was a research assistant for the Manton Center for Orphan Disease Research, which for anyone who's unaware of what that is, it's a group focused on rare disease at Boston Children's Hospital. And at the time, I was encouraged to go to some symposium over in the Longwood Medical area. And I remember sitting in the audience, and you were giving a talk. I think it was a keynote address. And you were talking about Usher syndrome, actually. I remember that. And I was just sitting there thinking, wow, this woman is like making it in science and inspiring everyone in the room and inspiring me. And I remember just thinking, you know, I would love to work for someone like that someday or work with someone like that someday. And, you know, now, you know, we're sitting here interviewing you for this podcast and everything is just kind of coming full circle. And it's been such a blast so far. And on that note, we're just feeling really fortunate to have this opportunity and to kind of dig deep on your experience as a woman in science.
Well, it goes both ways. It's been a delight to have the two of you to work with as well. I think we both enrich each other's lives.
Thank you. So if I'm being honest, it was a tongue twister recording your intro, given how many projects you've worked on and all of your accomplishments. You've pretty much done everything. And I'm wondering, in all of this work that you've been doing for the last couple of decades, what is the thing that you feel most proud of in your career so far?
Yeah, it's a great question. You know, I think what brings me the most joy is working on projects that I can do as a team with the community, where we can achieve something that pushes us all forward in ways that makes the world a better place. And, you know, projects like ClinGen, which is very much a community-driven project, is one of the, you know, projects that I'm most proud of being part of. You know, there's lots of other community-driven projects. I'm certainly proud of the work I did for over 16 years in building the Laboratory for Molecular Medicine, and that opened up so many avenues in my life to be part of the community that it was a critical formative part of my career, even though it was a little more inward in that, you know, we were building something at an institution, but it was delivering services, you know, to the world, to patients everywhere. And so I felt I could contribute but it also opened up opportunity to work with the community that's part of rare disease, other genetic diseases, both physicians and patients and scientists and laboratory geneticists, that whole community that together, I think we've really advanced the field.
And that community approach or collaborative approach to research is definitely something that's catching on in academic medicine and even beyond academic medicine. And we're kind of realizing we can't get much done if we don't take that approach, if we don't share our data, if we don't have open source journals that can disseminate information freely. And I think in a lot of the work that you've done, you've shown that it's extremely effective to quickly make discoveries and make progress in the way that we think about genetics specifically. So in talking about all of that teamwork and that approach, what kind of support and team has been instrumental for you in helping you through these projects in your career?
Yeah, I think, you know, in the environments I've been in, and I will say this is one of the reasons that I've stayed in academia. I've had a lot of opportunities and offers to go into exciting new industry opportunities. And I think those that environment is important and critical to our field. And I work very closely with many amazing companies. But for me in my own career, being in academia where I can pursue things based not on whether they're going to have financial gain, but in fact, whether they're going to actually make the world a better place. And it's not to say that companies don't also want to do that, but at the end of the day, they do speak to their shareholders, and they have to be driven in some way by the financial bottom line. And for me, you know, in academia, it's been really amazing to be able to be in a place where I can prioritize other things. Now, you always have to have financial support to do the things you want to do. And so I've had to spend a lot of my time, you know, in raising money through grants and other things. But nonetheless, those in academia, they tend to be the secondary things. And the goal is, you know, how can we do projects that really are meaningful, that really, you know, help us advance the science, advance medicine. And that, you know, that motivating factor is critical for me in achieving all of the things I've done, is that people and the environments have allowed me to focus on that path. And that kind of support is really critical to everything I've done.
That's really helpful to hear. I think especially for a lot of graduate students who might be grappling with the choice to stay in academia or move into industry even, for you, it seems like academia has offered you some of those unique opportunities that might not really be available in industry roles. And it also seems like one of the benefits of your experience in academia has been really the opportunity to improve genetics while also building community. I'm wondering how your mission in genetics may have started and how it's kind of evolved over time.
Yeah, you know, I think if I look back to the earliest stages of how I ended up in genetics, it relates to a personality trait, which is, you know, I'm very much a type A personality. I like to organize the world and make it more efficient. And so, you know, one of the things that attracted me to genetics is it was this very logical, organized view of the, you know, the underpinnings of the human body. It's like genes, and they are made up of DNA, which has four bases. And I could see how a gene makes an RNA, makes a protein, makes, you know, a function that does something in the body that allows us to work. And, you know, in that very simplistic way, it was so gratifying to see that I could start at the very basic level and see how that was all affected, and that a mutation in DNA would lead to a disease in a very predictable way. And so it was a very satisfying thing. I loved the science and the understanding of it. And I think that's what drew me to that field. Over time, you know, I continued to want to solve those mysteries, to try to understand why patients have these different rare disorders and what's happening at their DNA level that leads to that. But, you know, as I launched a lab that did genetic testing for patients, I could start to see that the major challenges that our field was faced in just trying to support that rare variation, the inability to interpret it in an effective way because the variants were so rare and we weren't sharing data, we weren't doing things in consistent ways. And that was the early start of me, you know, really trying to start projects where we had better consensus building around how we were doing things, sharing data so we could interpret variants better, creating resources to interact with the patient community and all of that. And it, you know, for me, it wasn't that I planned out my career early on. It just, every time I did something, I saw that we could do it better. And the next step was leading towards that path.
Yeah, and that kind of leads into my next question, which was, did you take this kind of stepwise and let each opportunity lend itself to the next, or did you have kind of more of a set plan for how you were going to navigate your career? And if you were to do it again, would you take that same approach to building your career?
Yeah, I mean, you know, my husband sometimes jokes with me that I've never interviewed for a job. And there's truth to that because, you know, one opportunity has simply led to the next throughout my career. And just simply building on both the things I've done in the past, as well as the people that I've formed relationships with. And through those relationships, the next exciting thing, you know, has been at my doorstep. And so I've benefited in some ways where I've almost never had to do a job search. It was just obvious what the next opportunity was. Sometimes I get frustrated that I've always had one job start before the other ended, and I never had a break in life. And at some point in my life, I will like end a job, take a break for a few months before I start the next thing. Throughout my life, it's always started something before the last thing ended. But that was in part because the next exciting thing was just happened upon my doorstep, and I couldn't turn down the opportunity. It was too exciting, you know?
Yeah.
So it was less about a carefully planned thing and searching for the perfect thing. It was just, that is obviously what's ready for me next, right?
Do you feel like it's something about your personality, or it was just you were in the right place, right time, or, you know, a little bit of both?
You know, it's probably a little bit of both. I dive into the things I do. I commit to what I sign up for. And obviously people, you know, want that kind of trait. So hopefully, you know, people have sought me out as much as I've sought them out. But there is definitely, you know, some degree of opportunistic, you know, environments. One of the reasons, you know, I've stayed in an environment like the Harvard community is because there are so many people and opportunities and things going on that there's just no end to the breadth of things you could choose from. And so, you know, in some ways it was, you know, more likely that an opportunity would fall on my plate in that environment.
Yeah. And it's actually kind of funny when we were prepping for this and looking at your CV, it really has all been within the Harvard system. Of course, some outside collaborations, actually a lot of outside collaborations, but your main affiliations have been within Harvard. Yeah. But when you actually kind of look into each project, they've actually been quite different. And I think it's pretty impressive that you've been able to kind of navigate that, you know, go from one to the next within the same system and have such kind of a varied experience throughout that. But I hear what you're saying, and I'm sure a break would definitely be good for you once in a while.
I've started, you know, forcing breaks in life. My new meeting free week project has allowed 4 weeks of breaks a year from the busy meeting filled schedules I have. So you have to, at some point, you have to say, this is my life, and you need to make the best of it. And that includes making breaks for, you know, vacation and family and all of the important things that you want to do in life.
And speaking of those meeting-free weeks, would you want to put in a little plug for that?
Of course. Yeah. I mean, this whole thing started actually with a planned vacation that got canceled after it was planned. But I had marked off on my calendar, but I just left it on the calendar. And when that week came, I just didn't tell people that I wasn't actually going. And I continued to say that I was actually on vacation. I kind of lied. But I
that's okay.
That week and stayed at home and got caught up on so many things during that week. And I just thought this was like the greatest thing. But it sort of like was eye-opening just how much work and productivity I could have in a week without meetings. And so I continued to do this. And I would plan vacations, tell everyone I was on vacation, but actually stay at home and work. And then I would still take vacations. They would just be separate things. Mm-hmm. But my team eventually figured this out, and they would ask me, so is this a fake vacation week, Heidi, or is this a real vacation week? And so, I eventually sort of, they became clear, and they actually appreciated that I would do this because, I'd have fellows and postdocs waiting for me to review their papers, and they knew it would get done during these weeks. And so they actually let me alone, and they respected these weeks. Later, Daniel MacArthur and I, and actually also other colleagues at the Broad, were independently doing these and coming up with the need for meeting-free weeks. Mm-hmm. And so eventually I said, it would be more effective if like everybody canceled meetings during this week instead of me having to lie to people and tell them I was on vacation. And that started my global effort to create meeting-free weeks for the whole field of genomics. And I started a Twitter campaign and wrote a commentary in Nature. And now a lot of people have joined on. They tell me how just amazingly productive they are. My own team finds it so useful that they've asked me to have more meeting-free weeks than just quarterly. And so we've actually now implemented reduced meeting weeks within our internal team. So it's wonderful, I have to say.
Yeah, and as some of the first people to try out meeting-free weeks, I can honestly say that they're always appreciated when they come around. And we always appreciate knowing that you also respect our schedules as well. But along those lines, a question that a lot of people ask us at conferences is what does a Heidi Rehm day look like? And because you are very transparent with your schedule, we know that it's typically full of meetings. But I'm wondering, how do you describe your day-to-day work?
Yeah, it's definitely full of meetings now, Zoom calls, as we all have. Mm-hmm. I average, in fact, I calculated this over a four-month period when I was writing my commentary for Nature. And I think my average hours per week of meetings was over 40 hours per week on average. So like, clearly this is why I need meeting free week really. But my day is a lot of meetings from at least the sort of 8 to 5 period. But those meetings range. Some things where I can multitask, where I admit I, catch up on email and Slack and do a few things on the side. And there are other meetings that I'm leading or I have to pay attention. And of course I can't multitask during those. And so I do get some, work done during the day that doesn't require a large attention span. I do start my day out where I try to protect 6 a.m. to 8 a.m. And that's sort of my time of the day when I can get some thoughtful time done, work done each day. And I try to avoid meetings being scheduled 6 to 8 a.m. And then unfortunately, like nights and weekends is when I do a lot of, paper writing, grant writing, things like that. Actually, nights tend to be more catching up on email because my attention span at that part of the day is limited. And then the early mornings and weekends are when I do the more thoughtful work. And then, of course, meeting-free week now.
Wow. And what time are you waking up, by the way?
Well, it's actually interesting. It's shifted a little bit with COVID. So before COVID, I would get up around between 4 and 4:20 because I do have a 30-minute, would have before COVID, a 30, 35-minute commute in, which I wanted to do before traffic started because I live 30 miles outside the city. And so I would leave very early in the morning. I'd get to work by 6 a.m. and then work at work 6 to 8 a.m. And then my meetings would start. And then I would schedule phone calls for my commute home, which was done in the middle of rush hour. So that was usually like an hour to an hour, 20 minutes. And so I just talk on conference calls, you know, ones that I didn't have to pay quite as much attention to, or just one-on-one, you know, communications, like when I talk with reporters, usually driving home. Mm-hmm. And so then I'd get home at, you know, I don't know, 6:30 sort of thing. And then have dinner, you know, catch up with family. And then I'd sort of multitask watching TV and answering mm-hmm. emails for like a couple hours and go to bed and start over again. Nowadays, you know, with COVID, I now sleep till 5 o'clock in the morning. Amazing.
So would you say that you enjoy this kind of lifestyle?
Yeah, it's a great question. I will say that having COVID happen and removing my travel and my commute time has really improved my quality of life by decreasing some of that impact, which sort of leads me to point back to pre-COVID and say, how did I do this, right?
Yeah.
And God, do I have to go back to it, right? So, I mean, I guess what I have to say is that it is an intense number of hours of work that I do work. But at the same time, if I compare myself to other people in the world, I think the difference for me is that I love every minute of it, for the most part. There are a few minutes here or there that I could do without, right? We all have those moments. But overall, I love what I do. And also, despite the large number of hours, I'm generally in control of my schedule. And when something important in life pops up, like, you know, the track event for my son or basketball tournament or my daughter's, you know, horse riding event or something important, most of the time I'm there. Occasionally I'm traveling and I, you know, I have missed a few birthdays in my life, but usually my kids make out better if I'm feeling guilty over missing something. but I'm usually generally there for the important things. And so, you know, despite the hours, what's gratifying is that I love what I do, and I do have some flexibility, you know, to work around things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And not everyone has the privilege to be able to control their own schedules, to have a job where they can be more flexible and take a break in the middle of the day, or take time off if they need to go to a soccer game for the kids. So even though you have such a busy schedule, it is nice to hear that that's not something that you take for granted, and are even taking it further to encourage that flexibility for others on your team and even the broader genetics community.
Yeah. And I guess, you know, maybe pre-COVID, was there anything helpful to you, maybe a two-wheel vehicle that increased efficiency by any chance?
Oh, that's right. It was really funny. I think it was the ASHG conference in San Diego, and they had scooters everywhere. And it was, you know, the conference center was so large. It was out near the water, and I had to keep going from meeting to meeting between the two like anchoring hotels. And so I started, you know, riding a scooter back and forth, and it was incredibly efficient. And so, So I decided at some point when I came back, I was like, we really should get scooters. We can go back and forth between Broad and MGH and the multiple buildings at the Broad. And I have to confess that in a night out with my Broad GP colleagues, where we'd had a few too many drinks, I think I essentially drunk ordered a scooter on Amazon. Then showed up a week later. Although, you know, the joke was that I accidentally ordered a juvenile scooter. It wasn't quite as powerful. But being the short height that I am, it worked out perfectly for me. And I did make use of this scooter in the good season that we had for a bit. So I did make use of that scooter for a bit. Eventually I decided it was healthier for me to walk more. So I continued to use it.
They are all the rage.
Yeah.
Yes.
I guess going back to that work-life balance,
I'm sure it's very difficult at times to kind of remove yourself and shut off your brain to work-related things. Do you have any strategies when you do get home with your family to kind of stay present in those moments that you've learned over time? I think for many of us, this is such a hard thing to do, especially now that we're mm-hmm. we're home and work and home are kind of blending even more than they ever have before.
Yeah, I mean, I've had a few tricks over the years. You know, when I first had kids, my first child, you know, it's the first time in your life where, and when I, you know, we enrolled her in daycare, where you have to leave work at a certain time because you have to be at daycare to pick up. And I remember the stress of like running out the door, you know, having done so little of what I had on my to-do list that day, and just that stress of running out in that state of incompletion of so many things. And it was very anxiety provoking. Whereas, you know, before kids, you know, my husband and I, and before I had a husband, you could just stay in the lab until you got things done, right? Mm-hmm. So all of a sudden your life changes in that way and you have to prioritize your child. And frankly, you want to prioritize your child. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I had to sort of fight with myself and say, okay, I didn't get some critical things done and I had to run out the door. But I had to actively say, you know, what's going to happen because they didn't get done? No one's going to die. You know, I'm not going to lose my job probably. And if I did, well, there's a vacation right there. You know, like you just have to sort of put everything in perspective. And I would actively say, you know, I didn't get all that stuff done, but nothing's going to happen. It's still going to be there when I show up tomorrow. And so I mentally like worked through that so that I could walk out and really separate myself from work and enjoy my child when I pick them up at daycare and not be stressed about that I just left a whole bunch of stuff at work mm-hmm. and be a parent and be, you know, a wife and be part of my family. And so that was really important, you know, in that early stage when you are just beholden to this, you know, needy thing, right? I think over the years, you know, as your kids get older, and they are less needy, you know, wanting you 24/7 like a young child, it's important to figure out how to connect with them and maintain those relationships. And there for me, it was about quality, not necessarily quantity. And coming up with routines and ways that you interact with your kids. And, you know, for example, I do work on the weekends, but I would position myself in the living room where my kids were. You know, I might be writing a paper, but I'm there if they had something they wanted to share with me or ask me. You know, it wasn't like locked in some home office somewhere, you know, disappearing for the day to get work done. And, you know, making sure that dinner time every night is a time you all come together and having routines. We still to this day have family pasta night every Friday night. And we all, you know, that's just our meal. We all come together. We look forward to it. And we, for many years, we watched Survivor as a family. It was family Survivor night. We had pasta meatballs and then we all watched like pre-recorded Survivor from that week. And it was the thing we did. And those kinds of things that really keep your relationship with your family going, you know, even when they get to be teenagers and want to have less to do with you.
Yeah, and I guess during that time when they were young, did you ever feel like, you know, you weren't able to necessarily do everything and you actually had to say no to certain things that, you know, maybe you're okay with, or if there were other things that you said no to and you wish you didn't pass up? Just curious kind of at that stage in your career, how you juggled everything.
Yeah, I mean, you know, you have to say no to things, and I say no to most things nowadays just because there's just, you know, too many things I get asked to do. But, you know, in the beginning, there were less things I was asked to do that I felt I could say no to. And so it was harder early on because you're not used to saying no. You're used to being in an environment where you do what you're asked to do. And, you know, because it's more internal environments where it's your boss asking you or whatever. You know, over time when I've become the boss, you know, I have a little more flexibility to decide what I say yes and no to, and that makes it easier. But it was hard early on to sort of, you know, make those decisions about, you know, what you really felt you could do and what you couldn't. And I admit, I said yes to most everything, and maybe that was, you know, my downfall. But I also still, you know, somewhat it was around priorities, and I still prioritized, you know, my family, my kids, my husband, when it was important. And, you know, and they knew that I did, but they also allowed me to do the things for work that were important too. And we figured out, you know, how to be a team. You know, my husband is an amazing father and husband, and he was an equal contributor. And that's critical for any woman to have a career and any man to have a career, is to be parents together.
Yeah, and I'm not sure how common it was at the time, but when you did make it to lab director at the Laboratory for Molecular Medicine, did you feel like that was one of those moments where you kind of broke through a glass ceiling of some sorts?
Yeah, it's a great question. You know, I think I had, by that point, when I actually became the lab director, I had been in the field of clinical genetics for mm-hmm. a while at that point, which actually has a lot more women in it. It's much more equal in that field compared to basic science. And so it was less of a thing, you know, of achieving that for me, because I had a lot of colleagues in that field that were women. And so it didn't seem as much of an anomaly. I think there are other fields in both science and medicine that are more male dominated, and that might have been different in those other fields. But I think in the clinical genetic laboratory space, it was less of an anomaly. You know, I think in my academic career promotion track, you know, going from instructor to assistant professor, associate professor, and eventually full professor, you know, when I started out in my first position as a faculty member of Harvard Medical School, and that at Harvard, most people start out as instructors. It's sort of like one step before, you know, the traditional assistant associate professor. I actually didn't think I would ever be full professor. You know, I just saw that as something that was something I probably would never achieve. And that my goal was maybe to get to be assistant professor. And you know, that changed over time as my career grew and I, you know, became more and more successful. And some of that was because early on when I took that role to build the Laboratory for Molecular Medicine, I actually thought I was making a decision to leave science and focus entirely on clinical genetic testing. And I did that for a number of years building the lab. I had to entirely focus on just, you know, launching clinical tests and building an operation to support that. And I had stepped away from science. And as a result of that, I just assumed academically, I wouldn't be able to build, you know, to grow in that ladder of academia, because I had made this decision to focus on clinical genetic testing laboratories. Mm-hmm. Now, over time, you know, the field of NIH funding, you know, and other opportunities started to focus on genomic medicine. And because of my role in building a clinical lab and doing all of this work, it fell right into that field that then, you know, opportunities for NIH funded research in genomic medicine began to open up. And as a result, I was really well positioned to be part of that, and more opportunities to get funding to build community resources like ClinGen, ClinVar, you know, other things. And so eventually I did succeed in that path, but perhaps a little more non-traditional, not in the basic mm-hmm. science route, but in more of the applied science and clinical research realms.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and probably some of those experiences, whether it was, you know, business skills or, you know, other pieces of knowledge that you were picking up and building that lab, probably set you apart from most other people in academic medicine, it seems like.
Yeah, no, the skills that I learned to build, you know, a clinical lab from employee of one, which was me, to, you know, over 50 people and run an operation mm-hmm. and build that sort of hierarchy of people mm-hmm. to oversee components of it. And you learn a lot of skills of management and HR skills and how to interact with people, how to build teams that work well together and have, you know, have all those skill sets. And I think that experience did set me up well for some of these larger community-driven resource-building opportunities that I engaged in, and a lot of collaborative science, you know, multi-institution NIH-funded programs like the CSER program with many institutions participating, BabySeq, you know, some of those projects, eMERGE, the Global Alliance for Genomics and Health, NOMAD. These are all, you know, programs that involve many people and institutions. And I think the skills I learned building a clinical lab probably did help me in that regard.
And while you were in that process, did you take any business courses or leadership courses at the time? Or was it something that you kind of just figured out as you went and just learned on the job?
Yeah, pretty much, you know, trial and error was my mode of operation. There were, you know, I did take a 1 week course at, I think, Harvard Medical School on leadership training. Mm-hmm. But there wasn't a lot of, you know, courses in it. In fact, it's been, you know, a criticism, complaint, or recognition, I guess, in science that, you know, we get trained to be scientists, but to run a lab is really a different skill set. And some people mm-hmm. learn how to do that, and some people don't. And that's, you know, that's just something that, you know, I think that is a challenge in the field in general. I haven't had as much training in that regard. More recently, I've been part of a broad leadership training activity, a whole series of activities over the last year or so that a lot of people, the senior people at Broad, have been involved in it. And that's been really interesting to sort of see it in different ways.
Yeah. And along the lines of management and mentorship, your role has really become at this point a lot of mentorship and management of various teams. And, you know, we've had discussions within our team, especially over the course of this summer, about recognizing the importance of making sure that these opportunities aren't only available to select groups, particularly white folks, and making sure that Black individuals and other people of color are included on these teams. But even going further than that, we've had a lot of discussions in academic medicine where we know we aren't immune to racism, and we do need to take on anti-racist philosophies for how we move forward. So I'm curious how you're thinking about that for a lot of the work that you're doing.
Yeah, it's a great question. And, you know, something I have spent some time trying to figure out, you know, what role or roles that I can play. And I think we each sit in different environments, have different personal environments at home, in our families, in our social interactions, and at work with different projects. And each of those environments sometimes needs different solutions and different activities to really contribute in productive ways to, you know, combating structural racism. You know, one commitment is making sure that we start at the earliest stages of everyone's career and supporting the advancement of everyone. So those are things, you know, that think about the diversity of workforce, right, and our hiring practices. But then there's other aspects of the projects that I'm involved in where we can think about diversity in other ways. You know, there's not enough patients who get genetic testing because of lack of access in healthcare and the disparities in healthcare. So can we be more flexible in our clinic appointments to accommodate people who can't travel here and maybe need virtual appointments, or, you know, can't call and make an appointment in the middle of the day because they have jobs that don't let them leave mm-hmm. for their lunch hour, sort of thing. And there's very, you know, sometimes very small ways that we can accommodate and make access, you know, to healthcare mm-hmm. easier for those individuals. And then, you know, in the projects that I'm involved in where we do a lot of work with data, you know, like our rare disease program, you know, can we prioritize samples and recruitment of individuals from, you know, underrepresented minorities? And if we prioritize them, we'll get those samples in, we'll generate that data and contribute more diverse data to science and to medicine. And so we are, you know, right now focused on recruitment of diverse cohorts into NOMAD as our population frequency database, into the ClinGen, you know, picking variants that are common in diverse populations and curating those variants so that we have accurate interpretation for, you know, the full diversity of individuals getting genetic testing. So those are just some of the things that I've been thinking about to take advantage of the environments I'm in and control that I may have to really focus on some of these issues.
Yeah. Yeah, I think this is, you know, definitely something we've talked about as a group a lot, that we are so well positioned to actually make change on so many different levels. And if we don't do that or don't try to do that, then we're not doing the right thing. And so I think, you know, we really appreciate that, like having leadership that values all of what you described and, you know, encourages us to seek out those opportunities to find children at young ages to mentor them, or, you know, seeking different ways to deliver genetics at a hospital. I think all of those things are things that we're passionate about, and, you know, everyone really in STEM should be.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah, we can't just leave it to the institutions. You know, we all have to do it at individual levels as well. And I think that's important to recognize.
If you are tuning into the podcast, this is the spot where we typically would have a sponsor, which we have not at the moment. So if you are interested in sponsoring our podcast, we would be very grateful. We'll make sure that those proceeds go towards organizations that are supporting women, femmes, and non-binary folks in science.
Well, this has been a great discussion so far. I guess I'm wondering, before we have a rapid fire question round, if we want to maybe talk about the wines that we're drinking today.
Of course.
Renee, how about you?
So I picked up this bottle. It's called Educated Guess. Not sure if any of you have seen this before, but it has a lot of chemical symbols and sciencey stuff on the bottle. So I thought that would be, you know, appreciated today.
That's great.
It's just a cab. It's been very tasty so far. And it's from Roots Run Deep Winery in Napa. And they describe it as fun, approachable, and food friendly, which is, you know, all of the things I like in a wine. So I've been really liking it so far.
Excellent. Yeah. Well, today I am drinking a rosé. And it's actually, I looked at the bottle. It's from 2017. I don't think you're supposed to age rosé, but it's actually a bottle that I consider special because it actually traveled from California here. I brought it back from Dry Creek Vineyard in Healdsburg, California. And yeah, I just, you know, was waiting for a good time to try it out. And it's been pretty good. It says that there's actually white pepper in here, but I don't really know exactly what that means. I don't think I've ever even seen white
pepper. Very sophisticated over here.
I don't actually know if I've seen white pepper before. So, but yeah, it's been excellent.
Excellent. Well, I am drinking a Merlot from Josh Sellers, 2018. I have to say I am not skilled in the art of wine tasting, or I mostly just go for a Merlot. I just love dry red wine. And if I was better, I would, like, when I have a good, you know, when it tastes great, I would write it down and buy more of it, but I'm not so organized in taking those notes. And usually when I go in to buy a bottle of wine, I go to the Merlot section and I end up picking interesting labels that are visually pleasing. Somebody would hate that from me, but at the end of the day, that is what it is. I love a good Merlot, but I'm less of a wine snob.
Well, before we end, we always like to end with a little rapid fire question round to just ask you some unprompted questions right on the spot. So, Deanna, do you want to take it away?
This will be fun. So, as a teenager, how would you describe yourself in three words?
Lack of sleep. That's hard.
That's fair.
That was three words.
Yeah, honestly, same. And we know you worked at an ice cream shop when you were younger, so we're wondering, what is your favorite ice cream flavor?
Almond Joy.
Ooh.
Coconut with almonds and chocolate chips. It's awesome.
I've never heard of Almond Joy ice cream.
Oh, you got to have it.
Our next question. I feel like I know the answer to this. Morning or night person?
Morning for sure.
Oh, okay. I figured it was just morning, night. Both.
Yeah, there's a little bit of that, but I'm a morning person. If you ask my kids or my husband, they would say I'm a morning person.
Yeah, I guess if you're able to wake up at 4 a.m., that definitely is a morning person.
What's the most significant piece of advice you've ever received?
Oh, that is a good question. I mean, someone told me once, they were warning me of, you know, that when your kids get to be teenagers, you're going to lose them. And they said, you have to establish, you know, connection to them before they get to that stage. And when I talked earlier about, you know, establishing those routines and the connections and fun things you do together, you know, that piece of advice that someone gave me, I think was really important. You know, my family is very important to me, and that advice, you know, I've thought and kept in the back of my head, you know, throughout that period of my child's lives.
On the other hand, I guess, what is the worst piece of advice you've ever received?
Well, I was planning to hike the Appalachian Trail by solo, at least section of it through Maine, 200 miles. And it was during grad school, so I couldn't take 6 months off, but I decided I would take 2 weeks and I would hike this section of 220 miles in Maine. And I happened to be talking to a colleague on a shuttle going through an airport or somewhere. And a woman was sitting next to me and overheard my conversation and interrupted this conversation and said, "That is the most irresponsible thing I've ever heard, to go hiking alone in the woods. You should not do that." And I was like taken aback. I was like, I didn't invite you to this conversation and you're giving me this advice. And you know, I was so like taken aback. I didn't even have a response at that moment in time. You know, later I actually gave it some thought, and I have answered that question many a time over my life to say, it is more safe every day that I'm hiking in the woods than when I'm driving my car and living in the city and everything else. Mm-hmm. So no, it's not irresponsible. And I ignored that advice. And I hiked 220 miles on the Appalachian Trail by myself. And it was one of the most amazing experiences that I have had in my life. So that was the advice that I didn't take. And I'm happy that I didn't.
Wow. Yeah. That's impressive.
Yeah. What software, app, anything like that has changed your life?
So Slack has definitely changed my life. I love it. It's a way,
especially right now,
connect to my team in one-on-one ways when I have so many people and don't see them most of the day. So like work-wise, you know, I'll have to say that Slack is probably it. You know, personal life, Waze. When you're someone who commutes a lot and drives a lot, Waze has been a helpful app for my life as well. And my Fitbit app that wakes me up every day without annoying my husband when I get up so early in the morning because I wake up by buzz on my wrist.
Our next question is, what is your biggest pet peeve?
My biggest pet peeve is people using the term variation as singular instead of variant. This is definitely a geeky thing, but I constantly correct every time someone says variation. I'm like, no, that's plural. It's the whole body of variants of variation. You can't use it for a single variant. So like work-wise, it's the first one that comes to my mind. I'm sure I have lots more.
Only a geneticist would say something like that, but we appreciate it.
That's definitely the geeky side of me.
Okay, so question, what is your favorite gene?
My favorite gene. I am still partial to GJB2, which was the first gene that I ever, not the first gene I worked on. That was Norrie disease, the NDP gene. That was my PhD thesis. But GJB2 is the most common cause of hearing loss, and it's a disorder that I've studied for a lot of my life and come back to in ClinGen with our hearing loss expert panel. So I still go back to GJB2 every time I type a sample gene or variant into something. It's that one. Yeah. My second one would be MYBPC3, which is one of the two most common causes of hypertrophic cardiomyopathy, another disease I've spent a lot of my life testing for and stuff.
Well, our last question for you in our rapid fire round. If you weren't a genomics powerhouse, what do you think you'd be doing?
That is a great question too. Honestly, I think it would be in the wilderness. You know, I've loved the wilderness all my life, despite, you know, saying I'm from New York. I'm actually from upstate New York in the lower Adirondacks. That's where I grew up on the side of a mountain. My parents still live in the house we grew up in on 40 acres of land. I, you know, learned to camp from there. That was what my family did for vacations. We went camping. And my family, we do that to this day every year on Squam Lake. We camp, we hike. We backpack. We a little less backpacking over the years as we've had young kids, but at canoeing, you know, I ran a mountain club in grad school for many years. And I just love the outdoors. And if I really totally left my career path, it might be to, you know, to connect there in some way, in some job.
Well, thank you so much for joining us. And it's been awesome to just kind of share a glass of wine and talk about your career and your successes and challenges over the years. I certainly learned a lot. And I think a lot of people listening probably had some of their questions about Heidi Rehm answered. And so, yeah, we just wanted to thank you again for coming on and sharing your experiences with us. And we will see you soon.
You're welcome. It's really been a pleasure. I'm delighted to be a guest on this this new launch endeavor that you guys are going down. I think it's just terrific.
Awesome. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
If you'd like to nominate someone to be on our podcast, please reach out to us via Twitter or Instagram at RoseanneDNA or our website, RoseanneDNA.com.
And in the meantime, be well, be empowered, and cheers. Yes.